zero.
So hi there, everyone. My name is Rohan Sant.
And my name is Daniel Olaya. And we would like to welcome you to another episode of the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
So on today's episode, we welcome a trailblazer in the United Kingdom aerospace medicine sector, Wing Commander Bonnie Possold.
Bonnie is someone who is well known on the international aerospace medicine stage and is the latest consultant in aviation and aerospace medicine. In addition to this, she has produced numerous peer-reviewed publications in aerospace medicine, is a private pilot, and a veteran of analog space missions.
I've waited such a long time to say this. Bonnie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Bo. Thank you so much for having me and inviting me on. I think it's a really great idea that you guys do this podcast, so I'm really honoured to be on it, so thank you.
That's super, super kind, Bonnie. So I don't know if you recall, you probably don't, but I remember being at ASMA back in Reno, and obviously I knew who you were, so I think I'd spied you, but unfortunately didn't quite get a chance to speak to you. What's been going on in your life since you've left, since after Reno?
Well, quite a lot has happened since Reno. So ASMA is, just for those of you who are not aware of it, it's the Aerospace Medical Association organization, and every year they have a scientific meeting, normally at a different city in the US, and it's basically where every single person in the whole of aerospace medicine around the world goes to, because it's a pretty small specialty, but it's just where everyone ends up going. So it's a bit of a crazy week. So that was in May, and so I've actually just come back to the UK, having spent 3.5 years in America. I was based in Ohio. There's an Air Force base there. I was on exchange, so it came back in February. So it's a big international move, and then I'm trying to gear up to go back out to America, to Reno, where actually I was presenting some of my PhD work for the first time, which was great. And then having come back from Reno, then I've been working on finishing my training, so my CCT in aviation and space medicine, and then just trying to learn the job that I've spent 20 years training for. So it's been a bit of a crazy year.
Wow. Yeah, you've clearly been very, very busy. And I just want to touch on ASMA, the fact that everyone goes to that place and it's a meeting. And actually, that was the first time I got to meet you as well. That was 2019. It's really an opportunity, the fact that we get all to mingle as individuals in this space.
Yeah, and for me, again, it was a seminal thing in my career. So in 2011, when I was an F2, I went to ASMA, and it really completely opened my eyes to, this isn't just like a little thing on the side. Actually, this is a big deal internationally. There's all these people who do it seriously, and you know, the topics are just incredible, and you get to meet the most amazing people. You know, I had lunch sitting next to the chief medical officer of NASA, who was chatting to me and I was an F2, and it was just really awesome. And you kind of like have to pinch yourself. So ASMA really is the big thing to get to. It's loads of fun. I'm really glad you managed to get out to go there. And did you enjoy it this year, Rohan?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bigger thing than I've ever been to before, to be honest. Like, I've been to some conferences here in the UK, but it just was not on the scale that ASMA really is. So it really opened my eyes. It was, and again, like, I think bumping into a few people that I had luckily met through the Principles of Aviation and Space Medicine course that I'd had a chance to do at UTMB back in 2020 virtually, it was quite nice to be able to meet some of the people that I'd seen only online, just get introduced and get the chance to see what actually is happening in the world of aerospace medicine beyond what you're just seeing on your computer laptop screen is pretty incredible, to be honest. So definitely a recommendation.
Awesome. And so just on that point as well, obviously it's in America, so it's really expensive to get to. And as a student, it can be really tough. I remember when I went in 2011, kind of put in my abstract as a punt, it got accepted. And I was like, all right, I better try and
Does that ring bells?
Yeah.
The year I went, it was in Alaska. I was like, oh, wow. Alaska's actually quite a long way away, and it cost me a fortune. But so nowadays they're much more aware of it, and there are loads and loads of scholarships that you can apply for, even if you don't have any experience in aviation and space medicine. And there's also a student group that are really good at linking you up with other people, so that mm-hmm. you can share rooms and taxis to try and keep the cost down. The registration fee if you're a student is normally zero, so it's normally free to attend, as in just like the registration. Obviously you've got the travel and hotel and everything, and also they're offering a mentoring service, so if you're thinking of submitting, you can put your abstract in like just a few weeks early, and they'll send it off to a senior person who will mentor you and help you, give you your abstract the best chance of getting accepted, which once you then have a peer review abstract accepted, that then gives you much more kudos to apply for grants and scholarships, because you know then you're going to be presenting at an international conference, so that really helps. So that, yes, it is a big thing and it might sound far off and just out of your league, but it's not. There are loads of things in place to help you get on your way and get there. And then once you're there, you know, like I say, like the two of you have experienced, you just opened your eyes to the whole world of aviation and space medicine that can seem a little bit small in the UK at times. But yeah, it's huge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for those people who haven't submitted an abstract or who even are on the outskirts of it all, I think my opinion is that it's still worth it, because you can have some life-changing conversations there, like I feel I had.
Big advocates, absolutely, for asthma, as we rightly should be. So Bonnie, what I want to do is, there's a certain question that we start off with almost all of our guests on the podcast. I know you've discussed this at length before, but what was it that got you into aerospace medicine?
Sure. So when I was at school, I joined the cadets, the RAF cadets, because I really enjoyed, you know, they were selling flying, and I was like, oh, great, I'm going to have a try at flying. So I really enjoyed that. In sixth form, I broke my arm and ended up in hospital. I was going to do science, like chemistry at university, but having spent some time in hospital as a patient, I then did some work experience and then discovered medicine, which is basically science, but with a real human interaction. And I just fell in love with the variety of it. So I was like, okay, well, I really like to do medicine now. And then I found out that you could do medicine in the RAF. And I was just like blown away that you could do this. But I didn't join up straight away, because I wanted to make sure that medicine was the right thing for me, because there are certainly some specialties that are not as easy to get into the military. So I wanted to make sure I wasn't really wanted to work with old people or children, you know, that sort of thing. I joined the University Air Squadron, and I met some awesome people. I got to do some traveling, I got to do some flying, and that's when I decided I want to join the Air Force. But I always knew about this intercalated degree at King's College London in aerospace physiology. So I applied for that, and I kind of got told no, but I didn't take no for an answer. And I managed to do an intercalated degree in aerospace physiology between my fourth and fifth years. And that's when I got to really, you know, I got to do a research project in the hypobaric chambers at the Center of Aviation Medicine. And I got to do some actual research, some physiology, and I got to learn about this extreme environment that I didn't really know was an actual, you know, a thing. And the reason I had to fight for it is because the Air Force at the time said, oh, well, look, we'll train you in aviation medicine. But I knew that the Air Force, for all the training of aviation medicine for all Air Force doctors, is kind of just a 2-3 week course. And I wanted to do more than that. So I wanted to do the full degree. So I'm really glad I obviously pushed through that. And then that gave me my research that I was able to submit to ASMR 2 years later.
Okay.
And then going to ASMR kind of opened my eyes to the international community. And so from then on, I knew that I didn't want to just do aerospace medicine as a kind of a side or an interest. That's what I wanted to do. And there was no other specialty that I liked as much. I like with aviation space medicine that includes the whole human, so it's not just focusing on like the heart with cardiology or the respiratory system. And then you do it in an extreme environment with most of the time enthusiastic, really dedicated people trying to get them to be the best that they can be.
Wow. Bonnie, I really want to unpick something you said that I found it really interesting. So you had obviously interest in university and you were in the RAF and you were doing some cadet stuff. And at this point, you were thinking, okay, how can I carve out my career? But there wasn't a pathway then. There was no aviation aerospace medicine training program. And of course, you mentioned, you know, perhaps you weren't keen on GP stuff or maybe understood that wrongly. So how are you thinking and how are you going to do that before training was there in front of you?
Yeah, that's a really good question because the specialty was only approved by the GMC in 2016. But having done my undergraduate degree, working with the Royal Air Force Centre of Aerospace Medicine, I knew that there were professionals in the specialty. So aviation medicine has existed for a long time. It just was used to be more of an apprenticeship type training.
Yes, indeed.
And it's only in 2016 that the specialty was formalised into a curriculum. But before, it still existed beforehand. So when in about kind of 2010, when I was graduating, those individuals who were already in the specialty knew I was enthusiastic and they kind of told me, oh, it's coming, you know, things are in the pipeline. And I basically just told people, well, that's what I want to do. So by the time I got to, I then had to make the decision of, well, should I do GP or should I do a GP and then maybe specialize later when it exists, or can I start my ACCS training on risk that it will exist by the time I get to the end? And I made the decision that I wanted to go all out.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to, I think just for the other international, probably non-Brits, it might be useful to just kind of clarify how the training process works in the UK. So we do medical school straight after high school in the majority of cases. Obviously, that's not always the case. And then subsequently after that, we do what's called our foundation year training, which is 2 years worth of general medicine that you do in medical specialties, surgical specialties, to give you a bit of a well-rounded foundation for your future medical practice. After that, you've got an opportunity to then choose what it is that you want to specialize in. And you've got various different options which are available to you. So people go down surgical training, or they may go down GP training, they may go down medical training, or they may decide to go into other specialties which allow them a straight path to their CCT or completion of a certificate of completion of training, which is when you become a fully qualified physician, if you will. And with regards to ACCS, what that's referring to is a particular training pathway after your F2 year, so after you've done that foundation bit, which allows you to cover a variety of different specialties. But then after that, you can still have a bit more of a choice as to where you're going to go to a little bit later. At least that's how I understand it, Bonnie. I don't know if it's changed since... for you.
Yes, and sorry if I didn't make that clear. I think when you're in your medical world, it's very easy to reel off the acronyms. So yes, if you do ACCS, acute core common stem, acute care common stem, then your third year is either acute medicine, anaesthetics, or emergency medicine. So I did acute medicine for those 3 years. But just on the decision of whether to do GP or ACCS, a lot of people said, why don't you do GP, because then you're on the specialist register and then you maybe can think about it doing it later when it exists. My worry was if I trained as a GP, the Air Force routinely, that's the type of doctor they need the most. So the Air Force probably at that stage would have wanted to just keep me as a GP and use me in that role. And I was worried that if I did that, I then wouldn't get the chance to specialise in what I wanted to do ultimately. So I took it on risk, and the Air Force took me on risk that they started me training in 2012 on ACCS, but I didn't transfer across to the curriculum until until it came into existence in 2016. But by that stage, I'd told so many people that that's just what I was going to do, that by the time it came to the specialty coming to fruition, I think everyone was like, well, isn't Bonnie already doing this? So that's definitely one of my points I always say to people. If you've got a kind of goal, then go for that. Shoot for plan A. I know people always say, oh, what's your contingency plan? And yes, it's good to have contingency plans, but shoot for goal A.
Wow. So it's clear, Bonnie, that by hook or by crook, you were going to do aerospace and aviation medicine. That was it. You made your choice and that was it.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
That's brilliant. My next question is of course, you know, with the ACCS, I think everyone who's interested now in aviation aerospace medicine, you know, comes to this choice where, you know, they need to make a decision, which route are they going to take? Obviously, myself, I've taken anesthetics, you know, and we'll see what happens in the future. So has Rohan, he's in anesthetics too, and ACCS anesthetics. And GP obviously gives you different opportunities and different freedoms as well. And being in a training program has its, you know, pros and its cons, you know, for such a long period of time. But I really want to hear about your experience doing that. And do you like the acute care sort of atmosphere as opposed to GP? Is that what you're more inclined to do or in a place to be?
So I really enjoyed my 3 years of acute medicine. I had an absolute blast. I was in London and I, you know, obviously covered all of the specialties, emergency medicine, intensive care, anesthetics, and I had a great time. And I'm really glad I got to go down that route. It also enabled me to do some of the aeromedical retrieval work, which was awesome. Like the physician level aeromed retrieval. But in the specialty itself now, I don't do acute medicine anymore. I did try and keep up locuming in an A&E at weekends as an SHO level. But now my life is just, it doesn't quite have the time to fit all of that in. So I really enjoy it.
Do you miss that?
I do, to a point. If I had the opportunity to still do it, I would, but I know that the amount of work that I'd have to put into it in order to keep my skills fresh would be, I just don't have the time to do that. I did look into trying to dual accredit when I was starting my ST3 in aviation space medicine, but at the time, because the specialty itself was so new and the mere fact that someone was now trying to ask about dual accrediting.
Yeah.
They said you just would have to do one residency after the other. So, your training would be over 8 years, which it has taken me 7 years in training, but I did a PhD on the side. So it just wasn't possible when I was coming through. And that's not to say it won't be possible for future trainees. And I do know that some of the GPs who then have come into aviation space medicine still GP, but they kind of do it in their spare time. It's not kind of built into part of the training curriculum. So you definitely need it to have an awareness of clinical management, but it's just not needed as part of our general job.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
So I'm interested then. So as a doctor working in the Royal Air Force, for those people who may be wanting to consider a similar career in the UK, you are working as a doctor in the RAF, but you're also working in a hospital in London. What does that actually look like for someone who may be considering something similar?
Yeah, so we don't have any military hospitals anymore. We used to, but because our military is a lot smaller than kind of at its height, then the clinicians were not getting enough people through the doors to keep them clinically current. So we decided to put all of our hospital secondary care doctors in normal NHS hospitals. So it's a really good deal in that they provide kind of extra care for the hospitals, and the hospitals essentially get an extra doctor on the understanding that they might need to come and go on the odd occasion as consultants because of military exercises or need to be deployed. But when I was in London doing my 3 years, you know, I lived in a normal flat and I worked in a hospital. Some hospitals you do wear your uniform if there's a big military presence, but I didn't wear my uniform. By all intents and purposes, it was kind of quite normal. The additional military bits I had to do was the odd course. And then in the third year, when I became qualified to do the aeromedical physician stuff, I used to be on call for the military at like 2 weeks at a time. And during that time, I just couldn't do on calls for the hospital because I needed to be able to respond to an aeromed retrieval. So it's kind of quite normal. You kind of feel like you're in the normal world a lot of the time. Once you then, you know, if you're a GP and you then go and work, on a military base. But for our clinicians, our secondary care doctors, they work in normal hospitals, yeah.
Wow. So you're doing ACCS and in your spare time or during working time, you're also doing aeromedical retrievals, so that fixed wing aeromedical retrievals. And how does this aeromedical retrieval and transfer medevac, how does it differ from civilian? I've had a little bit of involvement in civilian aeromedical retrieval, fixed wing, you know, small aircraft. So I'm really interested in how this differs in the setup and the type of aircraft and how it works.
So I'd say it's quite similar, particularly the strategic aeromed stuff, because you have a little bit of time to plan. So you're making the strategic decision to get someone back to definitive care. This is different to something like MERT, which is the point of injury in a battlefield, getting someone out emergency care. Those sorts of emergency in a war zone aeromedical retrieval obviously is very different. You know, you're in a hot zone, austere, you've got enemy forces and you need to get someone out, and you're basically just, the clinical care that they give them is, you know, just to kind of stabilize them and get them somewhere safe. Whereas strategic aeromed is kind of like civilian stuff. So you've got a bit more time to plan. You know, it's not a hostile situation at all. And you're just getting them back to a bit more definitive care. And you probably have a bit more time to stabilize them, optimize them before you get them on board. And we do actually use civilian aircraft if that's appropriate, rather than commandeering and taking over a military platform. But again, it all depends on what the military are doing and what aircraft they have to spare, and actually, you know, the cost benefit of what's better to use, and trying to use a military asset or a civilian asset. But we do use both.
Okay. So mix of different aircrafts. And did you enjoy working in more military aircrafts or more civilian aircrafts?
A bit of both. It just depended on what you had. You kind of just dealt with whatever what the situation was. But what I enjoy now is, so if there's someone who's ill, obviously, as I said, I'm not the one looking after an ill person, but my experience of having done some aeromedical retrieval, my clinical experience of having done ACCS acute medicine, and my aviation and space medicine knowledge of aircraft platforms and the, you know, what types of aircrafts we have and their capabilities, means that I'm now in a good position to be able to do those triaging decisions. So when the call comes that we've got someone with a broken leg, that we need to get them back, that I can, and it's part of our job that we do this on call, is that we would be part of the decision making to work out which would be the best aircraft platform, what level of medical doctor do we need to go Absolutely. And get this person, like more of the, like the strategic decisions as to finding a solution to the issue.
And so does that involve, I suppose you have a very limited amount of assets available to you. Does it, for example, is it like the first emergency that comes up, you know, you give them obviously the right level of care, but do you have to keep almost some in reserve for if something else a little bit more major comes up, or does that not really come into the decision-making process?
Absolutely. You prioritize everything. But I think the military is possibly one of the most adaptable organizations, that if you're doing something with a aircraft and then something else even someone even more severely injured comes up and needs to be moved, they will just do it. They will make it happen. And we will, And, you know, at the height of when we were suffering quite a lot of casualties in kind of the height of Afghanistan, there were many moves. And that's particularly when the MERT and the intensive care teams were very busy. You just get on and do it. And you have to prioritize. But if there's a job that needs to be done, absolutely, it gets done.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. Daniel, I know that you wanted to ask a little bit of a question about AVMED training and how do you feel about de-skilling, etc. Do you still want to explore that?
We had a quick introduction about that. And I think, you know, Bonnie really well answered that, of course, you know, if you're not doing acute care things, anesthetic things, intensive care things, you know, even if you take a week break, you know, I know that if I've taken a week break on annual leave, you know, I'm always a little bit stiff when it comes to the operating room. So I think you sort of answered that. I don't know if there's anything more you wanted to add on that. I mean, for me, it's a bit of a worry, you know, is, you know, would you lose that? I think the answer is if you try hard enough, you won't lose it. And if you make it a priority, you won't lose it because it's important to you. You make it happen like you have, Bonnie, in your own special way.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you don't have to do aviation space medicine 100% of the time. So the curriculum obviously is there if that's what you want to 100% of the time specialize in. But there are many people who have their own specialty and then sub-specialize in aviation medicine or have a specialist interest. So I know many anaesthetists who have CCT'd in anaesthetics who then get involved in aviation medicine. But it's not their 100% of the time full job. You know, they still do the anaesthetics. And we, as specialists in aviation and space medicine, we rely on those other specialties. So we rely on a cardiologist with a specialist interest in aviation medicine. When I have a pilot who has a heart problem, I need the cardiologist to be able to talk to about, you know, how best to manage this person. You know, when there's someone who has a pilot who needs to return to work having suffered a fracture and has got a bit of metal, or are they still fit to fly in an ejection seat aircraft? You know, I will have those discussions with the orthopedic surgeon. And if they have a knowledge of AVMED, it makes my life a lot easier because we can, you know, try and problem solve together. It helps things a lot. So we absolutely need other specialists to subspecialize in aviation medicine. We don't need everyone to do 100% of the time aviation space medicine. We don't need those all so many core specialists. So it's definitely, and that's what makes it so varied. And hopefully you'll have come across that when you went to ASMA, you met a lot of people in other specialties. Sometimes it can be a bit confusing. You're like, well, what is aviation space medicine? If there's all the people, what is the route into it? I guess that's one of my answers, is that there's so many routes into it. There really are.
I think that's a really nice thing to kind of highlight then. It's like, as Bonnie has sort of said, there are your sort of more structured routes and things that you can do, but ultimately it's about doing the things that you're interested in and not even making sure, but seeing how they ally into aviation and aerospace medicine. And I think it's quite encouraging, Bonnie, to hear that, you know, not the only path in is to have done the aviation and aerospace medicine.
Definitely.
Absolutely. And I actually probably I'd probably discourage it in a lot of people. You know, you spent years doing clinical medicine and dealing with sick people. And I would never want someone to try and get into aviation space medicine and then be like, what do you mean you don't see sick people? So, you know, it's a reality. I can just say, you don't have to give that up. It's really important. You can still do that.
Brilliant. And I think these points that we're touching on are actually really, really important, and people are going to find them really, really useful.
Good.
So, Body, speaking of the aviation aerospace medicine curriculum, I remember that in a previous interview that you'd done, you'd mentioned that obviously when you'd started in 2016, it was very, very new. And you kind of described the process of you almost created a curriculum by yourself. I'm interested in exploring that a little bit further, if you could.
Yeah, so the curriculum is out there. You can go and look it up. If you just type aviation and space medicine into a search engine, you will find the GMC, the
Many General are available. Medical
Council, the General Medical Council website. So the curriculum exists. How you actually achieve those curriculum competencies, that's the thing that's out for debate. And that's the thing that myself and my my colleagues have kind of had to forge our own path, because our superiors, who didn't have to go through the curriculum but have been doing aviation medicine for yonks, they haven't had to, you know, jump through the hoops of getting the workplace-based assessments and the you know, the DOPS and the directly observed procedures, or the you know, case-based discussions. So it was different for them. So we had to kind of guide them a little bit as to, well, look, I need to get, can we talk about this as a case-based discussion? You know, and you had to be a bit, you had to be flexible. So our patient surveys, as I probably alluded to, we don't treat patients in the same way that you do in a hospital. So my patient surveys, I had to get printed out forms, and the pilots that we were spinning on the centrifuge. So I got trained up to deliver centrifuge training. I'd give these questionnaires to them, and they'd be answering these questions saying, you know, were you happy with your treatment? And they're there saying, well, you didn't make me lose consciousness. So yes, okay. And we are involved with the specialty advisory committee to try and feedback these things, so that in the future we can make the training curriculum a little bit easier and more appropriate for our specialty. So rather than having these very clinical focused questions, we can have forms that are about your interactions with industry and pilots rather than patients as such.
I wonder, does the curriculum change whether you are military or civil? So just again, for context, the ways that you can be sponsored into doing the training program is either through the Royal Air Force or through the Civil Aviation Authority here in the UK. So obviously those are two different organizations with arguably different goals, but they both feed into the same training pathway. I wondered if there was a difference in the way that those competencies either are achieved or what each organization is necessarily looking for from their trainees.
Sure. So firstly, just to say that, yes, it's the RAF and the CAA who are the only organisations that currently fund training in aviation and space medicine. But there definitely will be other organisations. So there will be more opportunities going forward, looking into the future, as the specialty and as the curriculum develops, and they start to see consultants popping out the end. So myself and a CAA colleague, we're the first people to have actually come off the curriculum as it stands. So, you know, it's still new, it's still in its infancy. So the consultant role is different from the military to the civilian, but the training curriculum is a national training curriculum. So every single consultant who CCTs in aviation and space medicine has to have provided the same amount of evidence in all of the curriculum competencies. We go and train at the CAA for some of the civilian stuff, and they come and train at the Centre of Aviation Medicine for some of the military stuff. So we definitely cover everything. Obviously, in the military, because I have a different consultant role, I have a different focus. So I'll end up doing far more. So, for example, in the centrifuge, I actually got trained up to deliver centrifuge training, whereas that's not necessary for the CAA folks. So they would come and do a bit of spinning and a bit of work on the centrifuge, but we don't need to spend days and days getting them up to a level that they can deliver training, because that's not going to be part of their consultant job. And the same for me going down to the CAA. You know, I'd get involved in some case-based discussions, but I don't need to spend weeks and weeks going through specific case waivers and policy, because that's specific to their job. But absolutely, we have the same curriculum and we have the same training, but we have obviously different areas that we do a little bit more in within our own organisations.
It seems like this ground aviation, aerospace medicine, it's very fertile, and there's an understanding that there's different needs that need to be catered for, and different consultants are being grown out of it, and that people are really, really listening. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still in its infancy. So again, trying to highlight and make sure that we've covered off everything that's in the curriculum can be a challenge at times, because our predecessors didn't necessarily have to cover everything in the same depth that we did. And so that can be sometimes a little bit challenging. And you definitely have to kind of fight a little bit for what you need to achieve. But saying that, it's a really nice small specialty. So I think there's 7 of us trainees at the moment. Well, I've obviously just popped out the other end. And so you know everyone. And we actually have a tutorial every week where all of us get together and we take it in turns to talk about something to make sure that we've crossed everything off the curriculum. And so you know everyone, and then nationally, you know everyone, so it's a really nice, you do look out for each other. So for example, if we were running a trial up here, I would then message the CAA lot and say, look, we're running a trial and looking at this new oxygen system, it'd be really great if you could come up in 2 weeks time and come and run the trial with us. So we try and give each other opportunities and help each other out.
So, Bonnie, I was also interested. I heard that as part of your training, you had ended up taking part in one of these analog missions. Now, we talked about this a little bit before with Shauna, one of our previous guests. But I'm really interested to hear what your experience of that was. And if you could just explore that a little bit for us, it'd be really valuable.
Sure. So in order to cover some of the space medicine items on the curriculum, there are not really very many operational space medicine aspects going on in the UK. So I had to look elsewhere. And I came across the Austrian Space Forum, who are a full-time organization running analog missions. And analog missions are a way of simulating an aspect of real space to practice and to conduct scientific experiments in preparation for real space flight. So I was in touch with them, and I was fortunate enough that they chose me to be their medical officer in the field for a 5-week Mars simulation mission.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really awesome. So we spent 5 weeks out in the deserts of Oman, literally in the middle of nowhere, pretending that we were on Mars. And I was running, I was looking after the 15 people out in the field. And then we had a group of about up to 60 people back in Austria who were our Earth command. And they would relay our instructions and our flight plans out towards Oman. And we actually had a communication delay to simulate what it would be like on a real Mars mission. So it was 20 minutes delay in total. And yeah, it was, I was dealing with, so your general medical care, so anyone who had rashes and cuts and scrapes. I had your emergency medical care, so if there was a real life emergency, how to get that person to definitive care in a hospital. And then I had the occupational, the space medicine aspects. So we had 5 analog astronauts who are the ones donning the spacesuit simulators to conduct the experiments. So that's occupational. They're doing more than just sightseeing in the desert. And the spacesuits themselves are quite heavy. We were operating hot temperatures. So my job was to, from the occupational medicine side of things, is to make sure that they were fit to do their duty for the day, monitor them throughout the simulated spacewalk, and then deal with any issues afterwards as well.
How did you get involved in that? Did you just literally apply and you got selected? Was there an application process that you had to take part in order to make yourself a bit more appealing for that role? How does that work?
Yeah, so I mean, again, like I said, kind of come back to trying to forge your own opportunities. So I spent a lot of time trying to research, and I'd come across the Austrian Space Forum on a trip to the European Space Agency where I'd gone out as part of a course. And so I applied to them and I sent my CV and said, look, I'd like to be involved in your mission. And at this point, I was still within a year of having finished my acute medicine stuff. So I was still in date with all of my kind of acute medicine stuff. And I, yeah, I applied to them. I sent my CV. I had an interview with them. And I then went out for a kind of a practice weekend. I then had to come back to the Air Force and say, look, I'm going to do this. I think it achieves these competencies. Can I please go and do this? And they ummed and ahed about it and then said, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. And yeah, and then that it all happened.
And I like the way you described it, pretending to be on Mars. Obviously, it was a lot more than that. And it was very, very involved and very detailed and also science behind it. But when you initially asked for that opportunity to do that from the RAF, was there a grasp of what exactly you were going to do and actually the importance of experiments like that and experiences like that for space medicine?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I've spent my whole career trying to tell people about the importance of particularly the space medicine side of things, because some people think it's kind of almost farcical or just like a fantasy type thing. And actually, you know, that level of research, even though it's not at a European agency type scale, there were European space agencies that were putting in experiments for us to do on their behalf in this analog. And I had the curriculum documents so that when I went to my bosses and I showed them what I think this is what I could achieve, these are the things I could tick off by doing this, I can't do it within the UK, you know, they kind of had to, really. And that's what's nice about the curriculum is that you and the military in general, I've always found that if you go to people with solutions and say, look, I think I can achieve this absolutely. By doing this, then they're more amenable. Whereas if I just said, hey, how on earth am I going to achieve this competency? What are you going to do for me? That's a very different kind of attitude than if you go in saying, well, look, I've looked at these things. Could I do this? Could I do that? You know, if you go in with answers rather than just questions, then people are always normally a bit more amenable. And I would like to follow that up with, there are a number of medical students who are really motivated and enthusiastic about aviation space medicine, and they've actually created their own opportunities. And that's what I'd say to anyone who's interested in this specialty, is that you can't just wait for stuff to come along. You have to create your own opportunities. And just like you, Rohan, you know, going on the UTMB course, I mean, that's not very well known, I don't think, and actually that's a great opportunity to get involved. So, you know, you're going out and finding out stuff more actively about it, which is awesome.
That's very, very, that's very, very gracious of you, Bonnie. Yeah, I was really lucky, actually. I think that my particular medical school has got a particular affinity with UTMB. So I went to UCL, and I think Dr. Kevin Fong, who's an anaesthetist over at UCLH, is obviously quite well known within that sector. And I believe he's the one who's been instrumental in setting up a sort of partnership so that at least one UCL medical student in their final year can actually take the opportunity to go out to America and take part in that course. So yeah, if you are just so happen to be a UCL medical student, look out for that in your final year and definitely take advantage. That being said, you can also apply to that course without having been going to UCL. I had other people who were, I knew that had been students in from Australia, students from other places within the UK who had just applied out through the normal application process and being accepted. So yeah, it was a really cool opportunity to meet a lot of people from all across the world and absolute experts in their field. It was really, really cool.
Yeah, and Dr. Kevin Fong is an amazing example of someone who's done anaesthetics and then also has a specialist interest in aviation and space medicine. So yeah, he's another really big role model.
I'm interested. You also did this PhD. Now, was that part of your training, or was that something that you took a time out of training to be able to do? What was the process behind starting your PhD and then moving across to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and pursuing that project, as you kind of alluded to at the start of our conversation?
Sure. So the military aspect of aviation and space medicine, our focus, we have a little bit more of a deeper focus on research. So as part of our training, we put our trainees through a higher degree. So I knew when I started ST3 Aviation and Space Medicine that I was going to have to do a higher degree at some point. So I started thinking, what could I do? And I knew that there was an exchange post in America that is continuous, and we fund a medical officer to go over to America, and the Americans send one of their medical officers over to the UK, so it's reciprocal. And I kind of had this idea of, well, what if I could go to America for 3 years? That would be pretty cool. yeah, and I when I was doing the diploma in aviation medicine at King's, we had a lecture, some of the ophthalmology lectures, and there was a guy lecturing who'd come over. He was an ophthalmologist who'd come over from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in America. And I kind of introduced myself to him at the end. And I said, look, I want to come and work for you. And he kind of like said, yeah.
Wow, amazing.
Right, okay. And then I started asking around, and we actually have a little bit of a dearth of aviation ophthalmology within the military. So there was a bit of a gap. And suddenly it started, like the stars started aligning. And I then had to find a university that would let me do a degree with them, but do all of the work remotely. And that was a little bit of a challenge as well. But we found that, and the University of Birmingham have been fantastic. So I had to, you know, obviously do that. I then had to apply to the Royal College of Physicians to apply for an OOP, so an out-of-program research. So I took 3 years, which is the maximum amount of time you can take out of training, and I had to get them to agree to it. So I had kind of three bosses. I had my military bosses that I had to line up so that they would fund me to do the exchange tour. I'd had my university, who were obviously going to administer the degree, and then I had the National Medical Governance Organization to try and make sure that that was all teed up. And yeah, I kind of not quite sure how it all managed to turn out, but yeah, it did, and it was awesome. And I mean, I turned up in my first week, and you know, I wasn't too sure about what the project it was that I was even going to be starting. You guys know at med school we do what, 2 weeks on the eyes as an undergrad?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's about the experience I had, and now suddenly I'm doing this PhD in vision science, I had a steep learning curve in that first year, a lot of reading, and it was awesome.
So what was it about that lecturer that made you decide, actually, this is the guy I want to work for?
Well, I think the thing that triggered it for me was the fact that I knew that there was a post at Wright-Patterson, and this guy was working in a vision lab at Wright-Patterson. So I knew that there would be it was possible from a logistics point of view. And I also knew that there was a little bit of a niche, a bit of a gap in knowledge about vision. For example, one of my colleagues has got a PhD in the centrifuge, another one of my colleagues has got a PhD in hypoxia, so we kind of already have experts in the military in those areas. So I'd be more likely to get the funding and the buy-in if I was going to do a PhD in a slightly different area. So make sure that within the military we've got kind of experts across all of the fields. So it was kind of a bit tactical from that point of view. I had no idea what it was that I was doing when I started. But I also just wanted to go to America and have the opportunity to experience aerospace medicine from the US side of things, because as you guys know, it's a lot bigger over there. And so I got to get immersed in it, and I got to do a few more like career broadening activities. So I got to work in the centrifuge and the hypoxia chambers up there. I got to work in the consult service, which is slightly different, and I got to do quite a bit of flying as well, which was awesome, just because they have a different scale to what we have over here. So yeah, that was really fun.
So what do you mean, like, what's the sort of differences that you found from working as part of the Royal Air Force, and then I'm assuming you worked with the US Air Force over there, like what would you find the differences are between the two countries or organizations' way of dealing with aerospace medicine?
So the biggest difference between the UK and the US Air Force is, first of all, is scale. So I was working at a base that had over 40,000 people just on the one base. And we, you know, that's more than we have now.
I'm sorry, what?
Yes, I know. At a base that you'd never heard of, right?
And a lot of people there.
And so and that's more people than we have in our whole Air Force back in the UK. So it's just a different scale. There's no other way of trying to describe it than just that. It's just, it's not even comparable.
So what sort of, I mean, you kind of explored it a little bit, but in terms of you as a medical doctor in aviation and space medicine, how does the role differ, or your day-to-day activities differ, from when you were working in the UK versus working over in the US? Don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, sure. So I was on my outer program in the US. So I was just doing research. You know, I didn't have all of the other competencies and hoops that I had to jump through.
I see. Okay.
Whereas now, coming back into my full-time job, having finished CCT'd, I now get involved in a whole range of things. So because of my my research, I do now get involved in discussions about new helmets, new vision tests, you know, helping the military make decisions about procurement and buying new bits of kit for future, either future aircraft or upgrades to current aircraft. I get involved in air crash investigation. So if there's a crash that has happened, we'll be part of the investigation into why it's happened and what can we learn from that. Different bits of equipment. So we have a new bit of equipment, a new jacket. You know, does it integrate into the aircraft? Can the pilot still get out of the aircraft safely? How can we maximize performance? Mm. So we end up kind of supervising and running a number of different trials. So at the moment, in-flight urination is a trial that is kind of going on. Some new clothing that we're
In-flight urination.
Yes, so when you're in a fast jet aircraft and you're strapped into an ejection seat, it can be very difficult to go for a wee. And for some people, like women, that is more difficult than for men. So,
wow. Yeah, of course.
And as we're, you know, going longer and further, and we want to optimize performance, so we don't want people to avoid going for a wee because it's normal. We don't want people to dehydrate themselves. We're trying to come up with better solutions to make it more comfortable and just easy for people to go for a wee. So, yeah.
I got to push you on that. Can you tell us a little bit about what those solutions may entail? Like,
so I can't go into specifics, obviously.
Ah, fair enough.
Like, yeah.
I tried.
I can't name companies or anything, but yeah, you know. So, so the current way of going for a wee in a jet aircraft is to kind of unstrap your seat, which is dangerous because you're on an ejection seat, and kind of open certain zips and kind of pee in a bag, sort of thing, which again is a little bit easier for half of the population than it is for the other half. And then you have to strap back into your seat and, you know, make sure you make your seats live again. And, you know, it's really difficult. But there are devices out there that, you know, kind of you already put them on beforehand to then kind of pump or suck away your urine if you need to urinate during flight.
That is a tangent I did not expect to take in this conversation, but I'm very glad that we did.
And this is something that, you know, we're looking at for space. This is one of the key things looking at space medicine going forward, multiple EVAs. Again, currently the option in spaceflight is to wear a big nappy underneath your spacesuit. Yeah. And if we're going to be, when we're going back to the moon, people are going to be doing multiple spacewalks, kind of multiple in a day and day after day. And you don't want people in nappies with acidic urine next to their skin. It's going to cause all sorts of irritation. So this is something that the space agencies are looking at, is urination within a suit in an austere remote environment, in a closed circuit life support system, to optimize human performance. And that's what I like about aviation medicine. It's not just survival. It's not just that side of things. It's making sure that people can perform to the best of their abilities.
Yes. Performance and aviation aerospace medicine. The first thing that I thought of when you mentioned that was actually an invasive catheter. So I'm happy it's we're not going there with this.
No, but there have been people who have done that. I know pilots who catheterized themselves for long flights and then subsequently ended up having infections. We want to avoid that.
The solution I'm thinking of is have you heard of a Convene?
Exactly. That's a type. Yeah, for sure. But your Convene can be a little bit messy. So you obviously want to make sure it's like a well-fitted Convene.
Exactly.
And then you could also like have a pump on it so it's not going to like overspill or anything. So.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, with the sort of how to cater towards, you know, our female air crew, that I suppose it's a bit more tricky. But interesting, like I said, interesting tangent which I didn't expect to go on, but fascinating nonetheless.
Again, that's what I love about aviation space medicine is it involves every single aspect of living, and people can relate to it because everybody has a body. So when you talk about peeing, you know, everyone sat in a car for 12 hours stuck on the motorway and it's like, am I going to go for a wee? When I talk about a vision, you know, everyone's got, you know, can relate to it because it's every aspect of the human body.
So speaking with the vision project, so are you allowed, I mean, you mentioned that you were hopefully allowed to tell us a little bit more. So what exactly was your project and what was its relevance?
Sure. So you've asked a PhD student what their PhD is on. So obviously I'm going to give you my elevator spiel. So I was looking at helmet mounted displays. So when you're in an aircraft, you can project an image off the visor so that you can see either an image or symbology wherever your head is pointed. You don't have to just look at the aircraft panels within the cockpit. And that enables you to keep your head out, particularly if you're flying in formation or if you're refueling. It's a more efficient way of delivering information to the pilot. And I was investigating performance using 3D symbology. So at the moment, in helmet-mounted displays, all the imagery is a flat image. But with two optics, you can create a binocular image. So we have two eyes. Each eye has a slightly different image. So we have the ability to create this 3D image. It's something called stereopsis. I was investigating using that type of technology within a helmet-mounted display to see if it improves your performance on certain tasks. And then the other side of my research was also looking at vision standards. So up to 30% of the general population cannot see in binocular or in 3D vision. They normally just rely on the one eye to judge depth. And so we have to have tests in the military to make sure that the people we select have adequate vision to be able to interpret and use the technologies that we're putting on them. And medical standards haven't changed for the military for many years, but the technologies in the aircraft that they're flying have changed. So I was investigating using different types of tests that are more accurate, more reliable, so that we can make sure that we are recruiting the right people and then using those tests to track it to performance. You know, so do we need to change our vision standards as a consequence? That's about it in a nutshell, I think. I hope that made sense.
But Bonnie, that was a beautiful description of what sounds like a complicated thing, which is very multi-layered. And actually, you know, I've been following your stuff for a while and I didn't quite get it just reading, you know, all I could on the net. Obviously, there's not that much, but the way you just encapsulated it was really, really nice. My other question was, does this include augmented realities? Is that part of it?
Yeah, so it definitely was augmented reality. So there's a spectrum of virtual reality. Virtual reality is when you just see a digital artificial image. And obviously your natural view is when you just see the normal world. And augmented reality, there's different levels of it, but it's when you overlay digital images on top of the real world. And that can have added challenges, actually, when you're not in one world or the other. You're kind of in that halfway house. And you need to create an image that you can see both of them at the same time. And the one doesn't want to be crowded out by the other. You kind of need to attend to both of them at the same time. You don't want to just focus on one and not see the outside world, or you don't want to see the outside world and not focus on the inner one. So yeah, it definitely was augmented reality.
Wow. This idea of performance and pushing the limits of that, I think is really coming across now. And actually, I think in normal clinical medicine that most of us experience in hospitals or wherever, we don't really get to experience that. But it sounds like there's a lot in what you do and what you have been doing, which is really exciting.
Yeah, definitely. And but I would also say a focus in the UK is on safety as well. So if there's any way to bring down risk or to make things safer, I mean, flying is inherently dangerous. So how can we make it safer? So that's probably the first pillar of aviation space medicine, is the safety aspect. And then it's the, okay, we've made it as safe as possible. Now, how do we optimize performance to, you know, what are the performance gains? And then sometimes you trade off risk versus performance. And sometimes you have to make those decisions about what's the most important thing. But yeah, and those are all the decisions that I really enjoy, because you really go into detail. And it's very rare that you'd make a decision ever just on your own. It's in collaboration with other people, and often international partners as well. So you would ask your international folks, you know, well, how do you do this? And that's, again, what I love about the aerospace medicine world, is it is so international, but it's small enough that you pretty much know all of your international colleagues. So yeah, it's really great.
That's really awesome. So I just want to go back and kind of summarize. So your project was kind of twofold. You had one aspect was to be able to take advantage of the standard binocular vision that we're all possessed, well, most of us hopefully are possessed with, and to try and see how you can augment your helmet mounted displays to be able to do things in 3D rather than 2D as they are at the moment. And then the other thing was to be able to look at the tests that you've got for testing visual standards and to sort of optimize them. Is that correct, or have I not quite got it?
You got it. That's it. That's it in a nutshell.
Sweet. That's the elevator pitch done right. That's the elevator pitch
done
right.
Come and do my PhD Viva, I'd be extremely happy.
But so that's great. I'm interested in the visual standards aspect of things. So I understand that your role was more about optimizing the tests. I'm just wondering whether, the other thing that you mentioned was that actually visual standards haven't changed since, you know, in the military for donkey's years. Is there anything that maybe you could allude to or say about maybe those visual standards actually changing as technology becomes more advanced, and perhaps we're able to allow people who maybe didn't quite have the same level of vision before to be able to fly in military fast jets, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the whole aim of my work and research into vision tests, is that ultimately our standards were created back in the 1930s when aviation was first started, and they haven't changed too much. So the reason why they exist sometimes can be a bit abstract. So part of my job and my role is to look at the evidence behind these standards to see if we can change them. And some cases we might be able to relax them a little bit, and some cases we might need to make them a little bit more stringent. But in the first instance, we have to have a test that is reliable and accurate and that can measure to threshold. And then once we have that, we can then look at performance in a certain flight-related task, or what your role is that we're asking you to do. And we can then look at your individual scores and performance on a task. And when you look at a whole group of people, you then look at correlations. And if there's a positive correlation, so for example, those with better binocular vision do better on depth related tasks, and actually it really drops off when your binocular vision gets to this point, then your performance really drops off. Well, actually, maybe that now is giving us evidence that should be the standard for this role, for this type of job. And you can apply that principle to pretty much anything. And actually, I know in America, they have relaxed their vision, their color standards for remotely piloted operator systems because of the nature of their job. So absolutely, vision standards can change, but we need better tests to understand relationships between visual capabilities and performance in specific flight-related tasks.
So a Schnellen chart and the Ishihara plates that I learned at medical schools aren't quite cutting the mustard, is that right?
No, and I think this is a good lesson that you can kind of take everywhere else, is what is a good test? So as a doctor, when you get given a result, what does that result mean? So an Ishihara plate is how we, you know, historically tested color vision. But there's so many limitations. First of all, there's only one set of plates, so you can memorize the answers if you're extremely well motivated. So you've got a complete false positive. Also, you can have discrepancies, and they can fade over time. So you've got discrepancies in the printing quality, so it's not giving you an accurate result. So it's not giving you what you want to know. If you take that questioning spirit into every test that you come across, I think that's a really valuable skill to have as a doctor. So, you know, when you get a really abnormal blood gas, well, let's just have a think about this. Where's this blood gas come from? Actually, let's just have a look at the patient. Does it match up with the clinical picture? Was the machine blocked, or was the blood sample lying around for hours beforehand? You know, or actually looking at the clinical picture, you're right, I think I trust this result. So, and now I'm going to act on it. So it's about being curious and asking about results and trying to work out if the result is what it should be, and is it going to then help you? So that I found that quite interesting.
I really want to know then what the different tests that you used to, I suppose, what did you then come up with tests that can be used instead of our usual standard tests?
Not me personally, but the vision laboratory that I was working in, that's one of their core outputs, is to develop and create digital computer tests to better assess vision, so that then we can provide give evidence to standards. So for example, the Ishihara, there's a color, digital color version of the test. So you've got a screen, and you have different colored stimuli that pop up. So it's not, you can't cheat it. It's a standardized screen, and it gives really good results. And that's actually something that the military has taken on board. So our color testing is all now digital.
Wow. So that's a real example of that research that maybe that wasn't necessarily you, but the sort of research that you're doing is directly having that impact in the real world. And that's pretty incredible and remarkable, Bonnie. Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Very kind of you to say that. Obviously, it's not me specifically, but it's a whole team that I was working with.
Definitely. And actually, just thinking about it, this whole concept of having a heads-up display which changes in front of you and reacts with, you know, what's in front of you and the environment in front of you. Actually, it's been a sci-fi concept for a good number of years, a few decades. And actually, your research is opening that field and actually asking the questions that we need to answer. Like, actually, is this good for performance? And I never stop and think of thing, actually, is this heads-up display distracting them from what they can see, and what does that mean for the bigger picture? And that's what you're looking at.
Absolutely. And you know, it's about giving evidence behind stuff. So anyone can look at the new fancy bit of kit and say, "Ooh, that looks shiny and fancy. Ooh, I'd like one of those, please." But if you're going to be spending a lot of money on these things, you need to know, does it improve performance? What's the evidence? And actually, I found, breaking news here, that if you use 3D to try and pop out a warning alert symbol, actually there is no improvement in performance. It's just flashing on and off in 2D is just as effective. So don't spend your money on a 3D HMD to display a warning alert symbol. There may be other, and I'm absolutely certain there are other uses of a stereo image to improve your performance, but not to just jump out and say, "Hey, look at me." It's not useful.
The first thing that I think of when you said that was is 3D films. And actually, I think for me personally, 2D films are as enjoyable as 3D films. And clearly, there's a clinical example that you just said there, that they don't actually make a big difference. They don't actually increase our perception of what's important and the warning there. But there we go.
Either that, or maybe you're one of the 30% of the general population who doesn't see as well in 3D.
Possibly. I need to go and get that checked out now, Bonnie.
Yeah, I'm having that same issue, Daniel. Maybe we're both, neither of us will meet the military standards apparently for FastJet, but hey-ho, here we are. So Bonnie, I am aware of time, and I really want to thank you for being so gracious with your time, especially as busy as you are. Just to sort of, it's been an incredible discussion, I have to say. We've covered a whistle-stop tour through your life and being able to really focus upon some of the nitty-gritty aspects of the aviation and space medicine curriculum and how you managed to navigate that obviously tricky process. Then after that, we talked a little bit about your PhD project, what you were doing and the outputs that you and your team have been able to have. And it was a really, really insightful conversation. As we wrap up, there's going to be a lot of people who are listening to this inspired by what you've had to say and the way that you've delivered it. What are the sort of parting messages that you and advice you would give to those people who maybe were in a similar position to you a few years ago and want to do something similar to what you've done?
So I guess what I'd say is that aviation space medicine is incredibly exciting. It's really cool. It's about dealing with extremes and how to protect people, not just to survive, but to perform to the best of their ability. And you interact with industry, you interact with clinicians, you interact with technology and equipment, a little bit of everything. And I love it. And the message I would absolutely try and give to anyone who's interested in it is to ask questions, find out more. It's a small community, but there are lots of, and everyone is very enthusiastic about it because it's such a niche specialty. So everyone is dedicated to it. So join the Next Generation Aerospace Medicine Group, or NGAM. There's a Twitter page, and they can point you to medical school aerospace medicine groups. They also are just an area to meet other like-minded medical and allied professional people interested in aviation space medicine who might be able to kind of get you involved in a research project on the side. And in December every year, the Royal Aeronautical Society Aerospace Medicine Group hosts a one-day conference that is a fantastic way of meeting other people in the industry and just finding out a little bit more. And then obviously internationally, that you've got the bigger conferences like ASMA that we've spoken about. But those are the ways that I'd get in to start with. And the other message is just that aviation space medicine is for everyone. We need people in absolutely every single specialty. So don't worry if it's not what you want to do completely 100% of the time. And actually, we don't want everyone to do that. There's not many places. So there's actually probably only one or two places every other year for the full specialist training, and competition can be quite high for it. But, you know, do your other specialty interest that you're in, that you're involved in, just like the two of you are doing anesthetics. And then you can always subspecialize and still be in part and contribute really significantly to aerospace medicine. And yeah, the world is your oyster. It's a really cool time going forward, and particularly on the space side of things, as commercial space is just absolutely exploding. It literally couldn't be a more exciting time to get involved.
Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Bonnie, I'm really happy that you managed to come into the podcast. And for me, the most striking thing is the fact that you've done just so much. And actually, I think we managed to go a little bit deeper today about each of those things, which is really important for us. And, you know, you sweated when you did the analog missions. You were out in the field. You've done some aeromedical stuff. You've done the standard clinical aviation medicine. You've done so much. And it's clear that you're very curious. You like doing things, and you're opportunistic. You grasp the opportunities that come to you. And I think for me, that's the biggest thing that I take away from you, that you love the opportunities and you're curious and you keep on going.
That's very kind of you to say that. And I've been very fortunate to have opportunities, but I've also created some of my own opportunities. But definitely not every day is exciting. So for example, last week, I'm just writing my thesis for my PhD. So I'm actively trying not to do anything else. So there are definitely some bits that are not as exciting as others. But you have to create your own opportunities. And hopefully I've also inspired you two to carry on with your interest in aerospace medicine. And, you know, you're creating opportunities for others by spreading the AvMed word. So I'm grateful for you to give me this platform. So thank you.
Daniel, you had a question, I believe, to Bonnie about going to the moon and what you should take with her.
Sure. Brilliant. No, just a little fun question towards the end. If you could take two or three pieces of medical equipment on board a short mission to the moon, what would they be and why?
Oh, great question. So when you are on a space medicine, there's some key considerations you have to think about. Firstly, space is at an absolute premium. So whatever you want to take with you can't take up much space. And then ultimately, you probably want to take something that is multifunctional, so it could be used for other things, rather than just having one bit of kit that can only do one thing and it's just going to sit there 99% of the time not being used. It's not a good use of space. And then you've got to think about what are the injuries that potentially could occur that, you know, are most likely to need medical equipment. So if I could only take three things, I would probably take, first of all, tourniquet, because it's really super light, takes up almost no space. And like a trauma type injury is probably quite likely to occur, particularly if you're on the moon and you're building stuff and you're on EVAs, spacewalks. You know, trauma is definitely something that is high up on your list of things that can happen. So a tourniquet. I would then probably take a pen knife that's not technically a medical piece of equipment, but you could definitely use it to do medical stuff. And it's obviously multifunctional. You'd obviously have to make sure you sterilize it before you used it for anything medical.
yeah, probably.
But, you know, you could also, yeah, do all sorts of things with it. And then I guess the third thing I'd take, probably some anesthetic of some sort. So not like an analgesic, sorry. Because I always found in hospitals, sometimes if I couldn't sort someone's problem, if I could just alleviate their pain and make them more comfortable, that often just did the absolute trick. You know, I didn't solve all of their issues, but if you can just make someone more comfortable, so, you know, if I had some sort of local anesthetic that I could give that doesn't take up too much space, or some sort of basic analgesic that just would help someone, I think that would be really useful. And if all else fails, then have some chocolate for morale.
Tourniquet, penknife, and some paracetamol or morphine, which one? Morphine, probably.
What about morphine laced chocolate? that's dealing with like the pain and morale all in one go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or fentanyl lollies. Don't you get fentanyl lollies?
Yes.
There we go. Fentanyl lolly.
That's brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for once again spending the time to come and explore your passion for the field and as well as the career that you've taken. It has been a real, real inspiration to hear from you, and I'm sure that we'll see you around very, very soon.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you so much.
Thank you again, guys, and all the very best.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading and listening to our podcast. We hope that you gained a lot from it.
And if you'd like to hear some more stuff like this and much more, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you found this on. And if you like what you heard, drop us a rating too.
You can also give us a follow on our social media accounts. We are at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And once again, that's at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter.
Also, we'd like to hear your feedback and of course improve. So let us know your thoughts by emailing us at aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com. That's aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com.
Until next time though, thanks so much again for listening. Stay safe, keep aiming high, and we will see you very, very soon.